The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, President Trump announces his second Supreme Court nominee since taking office. And Judge Brett Kavanaugh is definitely top tier.
It is my honor and privilege to announce that I will nominate Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court.
Kavanaugh responded graciously.
Mr. President, I am grateful to you. And I'm humbled by your confidence in me.
But the left has moved from edgy to ugly. Has desperation set in?
No comfort for fascists!
No comfort! No peace!
We'll hear a more measured perspective from the left. CNN's Jeffrey Toobin.
Well, I think he was probably the front runner all along.
And looking at our soaring economy, will the coming, quote, trade war blow up the boom? We'll hear from Stephen Moore.
I don't understand the logic of the steel tariffs and the auto tariffs.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. While conservatives were euphoric about Judge Kavanaugh and the prospect of reshaping the high court, by midweek, a huge Senate fight was evident. Senate Minority Leader Schumer poured ample cold water on the announcement, stating, quote, I will oppose Judge Kavanaugh's nomination with everything I have, end quote. Mr. Schumer realizes that if he can destroy this nominee, it will enhance his goal of becoming the Senate Majority Leader next January. Earlier in the week, I spoke with the man whose intuitive hard work provided Kavanaugh's thoroughly vetted name to President Trump. I'm referring to Leonard Leo, head of the Federalist Society. The Federalist Society plays a major role in mentoring young conservative lawyers. They also provided the now famous list of qualified lawyers and judges to candidate Trump in the run-up to the 2016 election. And you'll remember, Trump committed to making his selection from that list. President Trump came through, as did Leonard Leo. He joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Tell me your reaction. I don't know Brett Kavanaugh. I just know of him and have been working to get him confirmed for years back to 2006. Tell us about him.
Sure. Well, he is one of the most distinguished jurists in the country. He's written nearly 300 decisions. He's someone who believes very deeply in the idea that if you really want to protect freedom and dignity and prosperity in this country, you've got to respect and enforce the limits on government power set forth in our Constitution. He's someone who, of course, has been in Washington for a number of years, but he's in Washington, but not of it.
Are there other areas that are even more reassuring to conservatives, Leonard Leo, about Judge Kavanaugh's jurisprudence?
Well, there are a couple of different areas that he's decided cases on in the D.C. Circuit. First of all, there's been a very important Second Amendment case, a gun rights case that he ruled on, where you'll find that his position is very consistent with Justice Scalia's position, which is wrought out of an original understanding of the Constitution. He's had a couple of cases on religious freedom where he has applied the original understanding of the Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses. I think probably the most prominent of those was the Priest for Life case, where he ruled that the contraception mandate was not consistent with religious freedom principles. So there are some other areas where he's weighed in. What you see running through his opinions, which is really important, is a very bullish approach to the separation of powers and federalism. And I think that's really important in our country these days, because if you really want to limit government power, it's really important that you respect the structural Constitution.
Let me ask you, Leonard, how long have you been involved in this process of replacing Justice Kennedy?
First of all, the president and the White House counsel have been involved in this process from the very beginning. You know, it's not always apparent, but White Houses are always preparing for vacancies. And so just after the Gorsuch confirmation, the White House was focusing on, you know, what happens if we get another vacancy. And of course, things got very intense right after Justice Kennedy announced his retirement, which was just a couple weeks ago, right?
And have you been involved throughout that whole period? Because I know you were on staff for a while, but you went back to the Fed SOC. And when did you reengage on the specifics of this nomination?
No, I've been engaged through the entire process. And, obviously the president and Don McGahn, the White House counsel, are at the epicenter of this. But I've been very, very heartened by the kind of intensity engagement I've seen by the president these past several weeks. I can't remember a president that's been more transparent and more intensely engaged than he is. Let me tell you, the president had very, very good interviews with each of the candidates. And this was a full throttle process. The president went back and forth, between candidates, their pluses and their minuses. He made lots of phone calls about all of them. He asked Don McGahn, the White House counsel, a lot of questions about each of them after the interviews. This is not someone who was just driven to nominate one person and create subterfuge and distraction by raising other names. This was a real game of jump ball. And all of these people were great. I'll give you an example. You mentioned Judge Ray Ketledge, Hugh. That interview was by all accounts, a wonderful interview. The president was very impressed with Judge Ketledge. He ultimately didn't pick him, but he was very impressed with him.
When Chief Justice Roberts was nominated, I got a phone call. Hugh, we have to release your papers from your time in the White House counsel's office with the Chief Justice, and because that's just what they're demanding. Will the White House papers of Judge Kavanaugh be released quickly in order to anticipate and get over this obstacle that will be thrown up by Democrats, Leonard Leo?
My understanding is the Bush Library, which is who houses the papers, is going to move swiftly in releasing the papers that can be released, and I'm sure there'll be many of them. And the Democrats can have lots of fun reading lots of Bush press releases that are already public. They can read dozens of White House menus. I'm sure it'll make for wonderful reading. And the American people can decide whether or not that's a useful allocation of taxpayer resources.
When do the hearings begin, and when do the rest of the nominees for the appeals court get up there, because Mitch McConnell's raring to go?
Well, we don't know exactly when the hearings begin yet. By my estimation, they can probably begin as early as around August 20th or so.
Not many realize what a difficult task it is for the president to offer up a Supreme Court nominee. The exposure is merciless with the vicious partisanship now dominating Capitol Hill. Not only does a nominee need spotless credentials, but his or her family must dodge shots from the liberal media and all the advocacy groups on the left. My colleague Mike Gallagher spoke with Wendy Long, who's been a peer of Judge Kavanaugh for many years. Wendy is a former U.S. Senate candidate from New York and the founder of the Judicial Crisis Network.
And let's just begin with the realization that to anyone who doubted why Americans voted for Donald Trump in November of 2016, last night sort of sealed the deal, didn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, this is what we elected him for. I mean, along with some other issues that immigration and trade principally, but when he more than any other presidential candidate in the history of this nation, Mike, went out there, made an issue about the Supreme Court, and he noted it again last night. He said, this is one of the most solemn and important responsibilities of the President of the United States. So I think last night really vindicated the wisdom of the founders in setting up our republic with this system where the people elect the president chooses the justices, and really the wisdom of President Trump, because he was so bold in doing what no president's done before. Before he was elected, he created that list of 25, and he said, I believe in transparency. I will nominate from this list of 25. He put them out there for everybody to see. And as somebody who's been involved in judicial confirmations, that is contrary to every bit of conventional wisdom. Everybody says, oh, keep your cards close to the vest. Don't let anybody know who you're going to nominate, because, of course, then the other side begins to tear them apart. And he said, you know what? I believe the people have a right to know. This is who I am. This is what I'm going to do. And he kept his promise once again. He kept it with Neil Gorsuch. And he kept it again last night with Brett Kavanaugh.
I was really fascinated by Judge Kavanaugh's acknowledging the process and the process that President Trump engaged in. I want to for us to both listen to this, because this I thought this was very important.
No president has ever consulted more widely or talked with more people from more backgrounds to seek input about a Supreme Court nomination. Mr. President, I am grateful to you, and I'm humbled by your confidence in me. Thank you.
Talking about the transparency, the way the president was really seeking out all kinds of counsel on this, it really betrays the narrative that that many people have, that Trump is just this, you know, loose cannon. He's going to do whatever he wants, regardless of what anybody says. It seems like he took words of advice and input on this process very, very seriously, didn't he?
Absolutely, Mike. I think he did. And he didn't come into office. You know, he's not a lawyer, he, like many presidents, you know, unlike Bill Clinton or other people. He also wasn't out to kind of pick his favorites, you know, somebody he'd known in his life. He didn't know any of these people on the list of 25 that he created. And he went about it in a typical Trump fashion. Trump wants to hear everything from everybody, and then he makes his decision. He's a classic great chief executive who takes all these inputs, and then he's the guy. He's the guy who makes the decision, and that's how he approached this.
In the course of his career, Wendy, he's written more than 300 opinions that span nearly every, I think, significant constitutional issue, including the separation of powers, federalism. It's interesting, McConnell, apparently, Mitch McConnell warned Trump that all that paperwork could make it trickier to get him confirmed. Let's walk us through that process and why that is, because evidently, you know, Democrats will seize upon everything he's done in the course of his career as a way to try to block the confirmation, right?
That's right. And you know what, Mike? I think Mitch McConnell is kind of stuck in the past. He's stuck in the conventional wisdom. He's stuck with the way things used to be done. He's stuck with that sort of mentality of the way to get your Supreme Court justice is to go into stealth mode. But look what stealth mode gave us. It gave us David Souter, for one, and others. But what is the right way to do this is, I've said this before, unlike in financial investments, past performance is the best predictor of future results. And yes, you're giving the other side a lot more fodder, a lot more ammunition to attack you, but guess what? There's no reason to be afraid of those attacks because we and Brett Kavanaugh and President Trump stand behind those decisions. We believe they're impartial decisions that uphold the Constitution and the rule of law, unlike, as you've alluded to in the program, what we saw last night on the Supreme Court steps. The Democrats are the party of the rule of the mob, and the rule of law is completely opposed to that. That's what his record is about, and I think it is refreshing to have somebody who's not afraid to put somebody out there with a giant long paper trail. It's a wonderful paper trail about the rule of law, and that's what we'll find.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
what is your reaction to Brett Kavanaugh's nomination?
Well, I think he was probably the front runner all along.
A voice from the left measures his speech when the town hall review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The bombast that has arisen from the other side of the aisle following the president's nomination of Judge Kavanaugh has been shrill. CNN's legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin was critical about the nomination in his first comments that evening and took heat from both sides. But we have to give him this. Mr. Toobin is very knowledgeable about the Supreme Court. One of his books, The Nine, is a fascinating history of the court and key decisions emanating from it. Toobin was my guest on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
What is your reaction to Brett Kavanaugh's nomination?
Well, I think he was probably the front runner all along. I think he is a highly intelligent, ethical judge who will advance the conservative agenda at the Supreme Court.
I wrote that there will be five originalists and textualists on the Supreme Court. Do you agree with that, Jeffrey Toobin?
I don't think Roberts and Alito are originalists and textualists, but the mode of analysis that they use is really pretty different from what Justice Scalia and certainly what Justice Thomas do.
I believe that
Justice Kavanaugh, should he be confirmed, will vote with the Chief Justice, or the Chief Justice will vote with Justice Kavanaugh more than 95% of the time for the foreseeable future. Do you agree with that?
I certainly agree with that. And I think he will vote with Justice Thomas over 90% of the time. I mean, I think we are in for a very different Supreme Court than you and I have known.
I do not believe for a moment that Obergefell will be reversed. Do you, Jeffrey Toobin?
Remember, all it takes for a test of Obergefell is for a state to ban same-sex marriage and say, you know, challenge it. You know, if you think that the Supreme Court of the United States is going to protect gay people now, I think you are sadly mistaken. I think it's much more likely to accommodate religious objections to serving gay people. I think if you are a shopkeeper who has religious objections to serving, you know, someone in your restaurant, to letting a gay person stay in your hotel because it's a very creative task to run a hotel, and you have a First Amendment right not to serve a gay person, I think that I think those cases are going to be coming fast and furious to the court, and I think gay people are going to be out of luck.
I do not ever see this court attempting to remove from state constitutions their protection of reproductive rights. Agree or disagree?
Probably agree. But, you know, abortion is going to be illegal in big parts of the country relatively soon. I think Roe v. Wade is gone. I think Texas, I think Alabama, I think Mississippi, I think South Dakota are all going to ban abortion, and the Supreme Court will uphold it. I mean, that is a big change in American life and American jurisprudence, which Donald Trump promised in his campaign, and I think he's delivered.
Let me ask you about the report this morning, denied vociferously by Leonard Leo, that there was a deal between Anthony Kennedy and the president's team that he would step down if Brett Kavanaugh were his replacement. That was Leonard just went out of his way to say, no, not now, not ever, never. But it is widespread on the web by reliable sources. What do you think if such a deal had been struck? It's been denied. But what would you think of such a deal, Jeffrey Toobin?
I think, first of all, I know and respect Anthony Kennedy, and I cannot believe he would ever say and ever agree to anything like that. I would not be surprised if the president said to him, if, you know, or through intermediaries, you know, who do you think would be a good justice? And he came back with some names that included Brett Kavanaugh. That I think is likely, and I don't think there's anything inappropriate about that. A straight up deal, I think, would be seedy. I don't think it would be illegal, but I just don't believe that Anthony Kennedy would be party to anything like that. But, you know, with his input on a possible nominee, you know, I'm sure. I don't think that's out of the question or unlikely.
Neither do I, but I don't. I believe Leonard, who was involved in this from day one, completely and definitively.
So do I. Mean, I don't. I believe him too, in the sense that there was no straight up deal. That just does not seem like the Anthony Kennedy I know. And it wouldn't even be really necessary. I mean, Anthony Kennedy was getting pretty darn old. He was tired. He wasn't. He didn't look or sound like he had previously. And he's a Republican. And when Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, said, "Hey, if anybody's going to leave, you better leave." I think he took that seriously. I mean, there is the possibility, unlikely but not out of the question, that the Democrats retake the Senate in November. And I think if Chuck Schumer is the majority leader, he will shut down Supreme Court confirmation as payback for Merrick Garland. So, you know, it was sort of now or never.
It is hard not to notice the economic uptick powering our country almost continually since President Trump won in 2016. During the long economic slog of the Obama presidency, it was often said that the 2% economic growth we were seeing was exemplary. So many people got used to it. Fast forward to just 2 years later. There is now full employment, and anticipated growth is in the range of 3 to 4%. Now the president has moved the conversation toward trade tariffs, resulting in jittery markets, nervous trading partners. My Salem colleague, Michael Medved, spoke with economist Stephen Moore. a presidential advisor and the head of Project Economic Growth at the Heritage Foundation.
Stephen, always great to speak with you.
Hi, Michael. Great to be with you. And boy, we sure did get a blockbuster jobs report today. This is an amazing ramp up in economic growth. And Jim Carville, Bill Clinton's campaign manager, said it's the economy stupid. And I think for most voters, you know, it's not only the economy, but the economy matters a lot, and it has improved. You know, we've gone from, you know, less than 2% growth under Obama now to, well, I'm anticipating, we don't know the exact numbers yet, but I think we're going to get about 4.5% growth for the second quarter, which ended, you know, on June 30th. So that's another blockbuster number. It is really interesting because, you know, when I was working on the campaign for Trump, I mean, I would debate Paul Krugman and Larry Summers and the economists at Harvard and Yale and Princeton, and they'd say Trump is going to cause the second Great Depression, and, you know, they couldn't have been more wrong about that. So, yeah, no, it's a great situation. We now have something like 5 million more jobs than we have workers that can fill them. So that's a nice problem to have, you know, if you're a worker. You know, let me put it like this, Michael. If you're, you know, a teenager or a young person listening to this show and or you just haven't had a job in a while and you want to get one, go out and get one now because they're out there.
I'm stunned. I'm still sitting here stunned by what you told me because Paul Krugman is a Nobel Prize winner in economics. I'm pretty sure that Paul Krugman told me it was simply impossible for United States growth to get above 2% ever again.
So that means we've been averaging, you know, for the last four quarters about a little over 3% growth, and the tax cut is just kicking in now, so that's been a positive. You know, and Donald Trump has a lot of flaws. I you know, I heard you talking about that, and that's right, you know, but he is pro-business. That makes a lot of difference, and I think that more than anything really explains this burst in optimism and growth.
I'll tell you what does strike, I think, many of us as a raw deal, and I think you would agree with us, Stephen, is the idea, the prospect of a trade war. Your best guess that we're going to be able to avoid the kind of truly damaging confrontation that some folks in the administration seem to want?
I'm worried about it. And I think that although I agree with Trump on getting tough with China, because I think China really is a special problem, I don't understand the logic, Michael, of the steel tariffs and the auto tariffs. I mean, I don't think it's a national security problem when somebody buys a Volvo or a Nissan.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
And what they do, they recruit black students to the school so that white liberals feel better about themselves.
Professor Walter Williams with Larry Elder. When the Town Hall Review continues in a moment, stay with us. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Following decades of shining the spotlight on failures of effort to improve life in America's inner city and the failures of public education in the inner city, no change is evident, at least not change for the better. Sadly, education in our African-American urban areas has not improved, particularly in staples like reading and math proficiency. The number one problem? Parenting. So states Walter Williams, author, columnist, economics professor at George Mason University in Virginia. Williams spoke about all this recently with my Salem colleague, Larry Elder.
Your column, College Destruction of Black Students. Why did you write it, Walter?
This a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, she came under a lot of the flack, and she just kind of casually suggested some of the effects of affirmative action. And she's a teacher in law school, and she pointed out that she's never seen any of black students who are in the top 10% or only a few in the top half of their class. And she was attacked as a racist by the university, and she was deprived of her class. So that kind of got it started. But I think that one of the problems that black Americans need to face is that schools like University of Pennsylvania, it's seventh rank in terms of law schools in the country. And what they do, they recruit black students to the school so that white liberals feel better about themselves. And these students have a lot of difficulty that they would not have if they were recruited to some other school more in pace with their learning.
And the other point you make out is that the K-12 education that most blacks get, you say, is, quote, grossly fraudulent, close quote.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, and I find it remarkable that black parents are not doing anything about it if they know about it. You know, for example, nationally, only 17% of black kids who graduate from high schools are proficient in reading, and something like 7% are proficient in math. And there are a lot of high schools in the country, predominantly black high schools, where not a single student in the entire school tests proficient. And one case I talked about some time ago was the city of Baltimore, Maryland, and there were 39 high schools in the city. And at 13 of these schools, not a single student tested proficient in math. And the thing about it is that you see that these kids are graduating, they come down, they're cap and gown, and they're admitted to colleges, and their parents feel so proud about them, but they've received a fraudulent education, and the kids are receiving a fraudulent education in cities that are run by blacks. I mean, in Baltimore and Philadelphia and Chicago and Detroit, these are, you know, blacks have tremendous political power, but they sit in just idleness and watch the academic credibility of black kids being destroyed.
Professor, in your autobiography and in the autobiography of one of your friends, Thomas Sowell, you both talk about the fact that this wasn't always the case. Tom Sowell grew up in New York, and he said these were schools that were segregated, but the Irish school and the Italian school and the black school, generally they competed pretty much equally in academic tests.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And Thomas Sowell points out that Paul Laurence Dunbar, in between 1890 and 1900, its black students, and there were no white students at Paul Laurence Dunbar, they'd received really shoddy financial support from the city. Mm-hmm. Its black students outscored white students in the whole Washington metropolitan area. So I think that we're blaming too much on external factors. Well, number one, for kids to get a good education, for any kid to get a good education, whether he's white, black, or purple, somebody must make sure he goes to bed on time. Mm-hmm. Somebody must make sure he does his homework. Somebody must get him up in the morning and feed him breakfast, and somebody must make him a mind to teachers. Now, if that's not done, I don't care how much money you put into education, you're not going to get education.
Mm-hmm. Professor, Donald Trump is called a racist by the very people who polls show want choice in schools. His education secretary is a proponent of vouchers so that the money follows the child rather than the other way around, so that a kid does not have to go to a school like the one I went to, Professor. I went to a school called Crenshaw High School, which was the school that was featured in that movie Boys in the Hood. Right now, 3% of kids at that school can do math at grade level. Now, if you're a responsible parent, you are mandated to send your kid to that school whether you like it or not.
That is absolutely right. And, you know, one of the disgusting things about these white liberals who come out against vouchers and they come out against tuition tax credits that would give black parents some choice, they themselves, they send their kids to elite private schools, or they move out to the suburbs to go to get the higher quality kids. The liberals would not begin to have their kid in Crenshaw High School. And the thing about the black family that people don't really appreciate is that right now 75% of black kids are born to unwed mothers, and something like only 30% of black kids live in two-parent families. But if you go back to 1938, only 11% of black kids were born out of wedlock, and something like 80% of black kids were in two-parent families. And so what the welfare state has done, it has encouraged slovenly behavior.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
we live in a new world, and Western Eurasia is no longer as important as it was during the Cold War. All the NATO allies agreed to this 2% GDP target, so they should meet it.
NATO on trial. The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, was founded in 1949. The alliance remained vital throughout the Cold War and after 9/11. But NATO has been diminishing in strength, with a long history of member nations not meeting their defense budget commitments. Appearing at this week's conference of NATO members, the president blistered some of his fellow members, particularly Germany, for their lack of funding and strategic thinking. My Salem colleague Mike Gallagher discussed this with Michael Desch, a professor and director of National Security Center at Notre Dame.
A lot of people seem ruffled by the way he's pushing at our NATO allies. You wrote at USA Today, NATO has gone from playing a very important role in winning the Cold War to helping create a new one. And you say maybe Europe needs a new approach to security. Do you think the president is correct to push at our NATO allies the way he's been doing?
I think on this particular issue, he's right in terms of the substance of it. Burden sharing has been a problem throughout the history of the NATO alliance. This isn't really new, although it's become more acute in recent years. During the Cold War, you know, when we faced the big bad Soviet Union, it was in America's interest to pay more than most of the Europeans, to maintain the geopolitical division of Europe. But we live in a new world, Western Eurasia is no longer sort of as important as it was during the Cold War. And I'm not somebody who believes that even Vladimir Putin's Russia is the second coming of the Soviet Union. So this is a good time to open up this issue. And I think there are two components to it. One is the equity issue. All the NATO allies agreed to this 2% GDP target, so they should meet it. But secondly, right. I think that the fact that a large number of NATO allies are not meeting it also suggests something about their view of how serious the threat to Europe is, and also, candidly, a view that, the United States will continue to provide security, so, we can sort of free ride on this. Mm-hmm. That's rational behavior. And as I said, it's been a longstanding problem. But, this is probably the time to reopen the books on it. Now, all that said, I wish the president had done it in a little less ham-handed way. And I'm also not comfortable with him tying this whole thing up with the trade fight with the G7. I think right. Those are two separate issues. They both should be addressed. But putting them all together and putting a Vladimir Putin cherry on top of it is a recipe for giving a lot of people perhaps unnecessary heartburn.
I'm intrigued by the way you've worded it. So basically, if we can summarize, you're glad these issues are being raised. You're just not real comfortable with the way he's raised them. And that perhaps sums up everything where we are right now as a country, as it applies to all things related to President Trump. And it's an objective thing. It's a subjective thing. Dr. Desh, many Americans love the fight, love the battle. And I don't want to get into a back and forth over style, over substance. But, it does seem to me the U.S. role in NATO has been a focal point for Trump all from day one, way before he was elected president. So I think for a lot of people, even scholarly folks like yourself, there's some relief that some of these issues are finally like stones being overturned. These are starting to see the light of day.
Yeah, I mean, governments ought to be asking on a regular basis if their security commitments, which were made, in the past and in a very different geopolitical environment, still make sense today.
Right.
And, that's a good thing. I mean, that's what we pay our
elected officials
to be doing.
Exactly.
And so raising these issues is not bad. I do think, though, style matters. My grandma taught me that you get more flies with honey than vinegar. So,
he seems to be getting a lot of flies. I mean, and he is the guy we got. I mean, there isn't a plan B as far as the president of the United States. So he's the guy that's in the driver's seat right now. We're talking to Dr. Michael Desh from Notre Dame, writes a very interesting piece about how the president, frankly, there are some issues that need to to be raised about our role in NATO. I'm intrigued, of course, by, as everybody is, about the whole Russian connection, as you alluded to. It's funny because the president had a back and forth with the head of NATO, and he said, you know, and this Stoltenberg said, well, we're stronger together, you know. And Trump said, well, how can you be together when you're getting energy from the group you want protection from? And he pointed out that Germany gets energy from Russia, and said that Germany was totally controlled by and captive to Russia over a pipeline project. Does he have a point, Dr. Desch?
Well, again, I think he's overstating it, but, you know, at the core of it, it's absolutely true that Russia exports a lot of natural gas to Western Europe and particularly Germany. And that's an important thing to recognize. Right. Now, I wouldn't put a nefarious spin on it. I mean, this is business.
Right.
But, you know, what it also underlines is that if the Germans were so afraid of the Russians, they wouldn't be involved in this sort of economic relationship and substantial energy dependence on Putin's Russia. And, you know, so what it indicates is that the relationship between Germany and Russia is more complicated. That, yeah, the Germans are unhappy with, you know, Putin's seizure of Crimea and, you know, turning the heat up under, you know, the unrest in eastern Ukraine, and probably doesn't like the military deployments in the Baltic region. But on the other hand, they do business with the Russians. And that's what diplomacy is all about. You trade with people and you talk to people that may not be the folks you want to invite over for Sunday dinner, but, you know, that it's the people you have to work with.
To hear Mike's complete interview with Michael Desch, please go to townhallreview.com. While you're there, take a moment to sign up for a podcast of our program and get the best interviews each and every day. I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up,
they don't have a Bible to guide them. They don't have a Constitution to guide them. They don't have any set rules to guide them. They are so arrogant, they make up their own rules.
Dennis Prager, when the final segment of the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Recently, demonstrators accosted Senate Leader McConnell at a Kentucky restaurant. Press Secretary Sanders with her family at Virginia's Red Hen restaurant were rudely asked to leave. What's going on and where's this heading? My colleague Dennis Prager asked some questions about this growing phenomenon on the Dennis Prager Show.
No comfort for fascists!
No comfort!
No peace! No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
These are bright people, obviously. Deep. They're all deep. They have a lot of time on their hands. The one thing I could say for them. Yeah, this is following Mitch McConnell. So what we have a debate here at the Prager Show. I would like to see this done to Democratic representatives as it is done to Republicans. But the thing is, we won't do it. And I totally understand it. It's very hard for us to get as low as the left. It just is. It's not in our DNA. If Barack Obama walked into a room, I would stand up. I wouldn't, not only would I not heckle him, I would have stood up because he's the president of the United States. I loathed the man. I thought he was an intellectual fraud and a leftist of the first degree. Okay? And leftists ruin everything. Nevertheless, I would have stood up. That's correct. I give you my word of honor, just as I did for Jimmy Carter when I, so to speak, bumped into him in a radio studio many years ago, and I can't stand Jimmy Carter. We are conservative, so we like to conserve rules of order. We like to conserve decency. But the people on the further left you get, the more they make up their own rules of life. They don't have a Bible to guide them. They don't have a Constitution to guide them. They don't have any set rules to guide them. They are so arrogant, they make up their own rules. Fascist, abolish ICE. That means abolish borders. Abolish ICE means abolish borders. Anybody who wants to come in this country should come in. That's what they believe. They don't believe in the United States any more than I believe in alchemy. There it is. Here it is. This is what they were screaming to Christian Nielsen. Sanctuary for all. No borders, no walls. There you go. End Texas concentration camps. As a Jew, may I say, screw you. You have offended the millions who died in concentration camps. You have cheapened the word concentration camp. That's what they've done. That's what they do. That's what they did on Morning Joe. When this moron named Donnie Deutsch says to a quiet Joe Scarborough, who silently listens when he says every single person who supports Donald Trump is a Nazi. The Nazis ain't so bad, are they? The cheapening of evil. That should be one of the left's mottos. We cheapen evil. There's no evil so bad that we can't cheapen it. How does this wonderful country produce so many people with sick values? How does it happen?
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin, producer Charlie Richards, David Posehn, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.